these dark times, we need to remember that the dream of revolution was rooted in what Dr. King called a dangerous unselfishness. The idea that we have no choice but to make a difference in the lives of the most vulnerable. I mean, that's what he talked about in his final speech before he died, a dangerous unselfishness. If we are to carry the spirit of 68, we have to create a university that doesn't just serve the needs of aggrieved communities, but draws on knowledge embedded in those communities. We have to become partners in knowledge production to maintain an organic relationship to social movements, the incubators of emancipatory thinking. Thank you.
That's Robin Kelly, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Robin Kelly on the dream of revolution. In some ways, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered twice, first by an assassin's bullet in Memphis, and then by killing his revolutionary message. Today, King is largely remembered with special holiday sales. His vision of radical revolution muted. He posed a special threat to the power structure. It was one thing to demand desegregation of lunch counters, and quite another when in his Beyond Vietnam speech, he called for a radical redistribution of economic and political power, a revolution of values. He said, "We must see now that the evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are all tied together. The whole structure of American life must be changed." Those words in 1967 resonate today. The dream of revolution, of creating a society based on equality and justice, lives on. Our guest today is Robin Kelly, professor of history at UCLA and an award-winning author. Among his many books are Race Rebels, Yo Mama's Dysfunctional, Thelonious Monk, and Africa Speaks, America Answers. He spoke at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And now, Robin Kelly.
Let's begin with one of the greatest philosophers who ever lived, Dr. Martin Luther King. His ideas become, of course, more radical in 68. So he and Coretta really stood steadfast against the Vietnam War in 66, when you begin to see opposition to the war from the King family. Coretta much before Martin. And, you know, they're opposed to all forms of U.S. interventions, while also championing third world revolutions, which Dr. King regarded as a wave of a global democratic future. In his famous Beyond Vietnam speech delivered exactly, you know, April 4th, 1967, he warned that our very survival depends on shifting from what he calls a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. He called for a revolution in values in order to challenge what he calls the triplets of racism, militarism, and materialism. So for an author like George Costa-Fakis, he wrote this book called The Global Imagination of 1968. And by the way, there's a new reprinted version of that book. I would really urge you to read that book. It's a very important book. And he focuses on the rise of the new left as a world historical development in 68. And therefore, his analysis examined what he calls the core of the world system to illuminate the possibility of such world historical revolution. And in doing so, he basically identified certain characteristics of these insurgencies, and here are five of them. One is opposition to racial, political, and patriarchal domination, as well as to economic exploitation, a concept of freedom as not only freedom from material deprivation, but also freedom to create new human beings. And here the emphasis is on new identities, on creating new cultures, in opposition to consumer culture. So much of what we think of as identity politics in a very positive way is about recognizing identities that can't be reduced to class or to economics. The extension of democracy and expansion of individual rights, not their constraint, right? That we would have new expanded rights, new forms of democracy, including economic democracy. enlarged base of revolution that is not limited to class conflict or class struggle framework of the proletarian identification, but really to incorporate what he calls the middle strata as well as the so-called lumpen. Lumpen meaning those who are sort of pushed outside of the economy on the edges of it. Not just hustlers, by the way. People think lumpen are all hustlers. Some lumpen are just like homeless people struggling. And of course, an emphasis on direct action. As I said, King said we needed a revolution of values. And that was going to be the future. And he was right about one thing, that there was a revolution in values. It's just not the white revolution, okay? So instead, what revolution did we get? We get the neoliberal revolution, placing an ethical imperative for justice, which was King's vision, and the vision of the global New Left. Instead of that, we got neoliberal reason. That is the idea that market principles should govern all spheres of life, and therefore virtually everything should be privatized outside the domain of the state. We get personal responsibility and family values replacing the very idea that there's a social, that the social is us, the social is the collective. And that is to say that the nation is responsible for collectively providing for those in need. In other words, the elimination of all expectations of state provisions will somehow make us more responsible for ourselves and enhance competition and productivity. And the fact that we come up saying things like, you know, I got to protect my brand. I mean, do you really have a brand? Do you know what a brand is? Brand comes from marking animals and human beings as property. Like, really? Do you want to say that? If you tweet that again, take it back. Eliminate it. Okay? So the state is not eliminated. Rather, it continues to take on coercive functions. And this idea of no society, this is Margaret Thatcher. This is Ronald Reagan. This is, you know, what we think of as neoconservative, but specifically neoliberal kind of conception. And the other thing is it takes on the identity, the state takes on the identity of a corporation or a firm with managerial functions. And so in that particular political formulation, you actually don't need a president, you need a CEO. So democracy and accountability are replaced by the norms of good management, efficiency, effectiveness, profitability. Okay, so I want to go back. The neoliberal revolution was not inevitable. And this is, I really want to emphasize this. This was a struggle. I want to suggest that we think of 68 not as like the pinnacle of global insurgencies or the beginnings of a right-wing turn with Nixon's election. In fact, we think about 68 as like a contested terrain where the future is not clear, right? It's still not clear. The future is still not, we're not done yet. This idea, this kind of narrative that we often get in our history courses where the country makes a right turn, as if somehow before that moment in 68, it was progressive. That's one of the biggest, like we're already moving in this progressive direction and all of a sudden it turns. Remember, 68 is the battle to turn the country into a radical direction. And it failed, it was defeated, but not permanently, okay? And I want to say a little more about that. So if you think of this as contested visions of the future, that 68 marks that moment of contestation. Some won, some lost. Some aspects of 68 vision actually won, much of it lost. Then what we could do is we could think of that moment as at least four competing visions. One would be the dominant Keynesian welfare warfare state, because that's the direction that America was moving in at the time. There's also the neoliberal vision I just outlined, the social conservatism. And then the other one, which is I associate with the spirit of 68, is a radical democracy. A radical democracy based on economic, racial, gender, justice, on national sovereignty, self-determination, and sexual freedom. That these are the kinds of demands that end up on that list that George Kostopoulos was establishing. In other words, this last thing, the struggle for radical democracy, was not a call for reform. It was a call for revolution. It was backed by people who were in some ways at the edge or excluded or dispossessed. The 68 generation of activists had come to see that the system could not be fixed, but had to be overthrown. And this is the most important thing, and if you want to write down anything, write this down. They saw liberalism as a failure. Liberalism was the problem. Why? How could I say that? Well, what's the context? Now, I don't know. Actually, I'd had some other slides, and I took them out. So imagine is a picture of an anti-war demonstration. So there's the war in Vietnam. The key here is that liberals, not conservatives, were responsible for escalating the war and expanding U.S. imperial power. And that war was shrouded in lies and misrepresentations. Don't get confused. I'm not saying that conservatives were against the war. No, they just weren't the ones in power. They supported the war. They pushed for even more war. But remember, this is the Johnson administration. The war on poverty and the war on Southeast Asia, as well as the war in Dominican Republic, in Brazil, in, you know, we talk about Cuba, Chile, Southern Africa, Indonesia. We can go on and on and on. Liberals were behind that, right? They felt there were important wars. The other thing, you have a massive expansion of universities due to federal subsidies, population growth, general affluence, and those universities become the staging grounds for this revolutionary insurgency. It doesn't mean it's everybody, but again, if you got 10%, that's a lot, right? So that's also part of it. This is also, in some ways, a reaction to certain things that are happening in modern society. The pressures to conform, the pervasiveness of mindless consumer society, what Herbert Marcuse critiqued in his book, One Dimensional Man, a response to anti-communism as a way of life, the threat to constant nuclear war, the threat to ecological destruction, which is very, very clear. I mean, Rachel Carson's book comes out in 1962. This is not a new thing. This is something that's really escalating. And increased sexual and gender repression. So this is what people are responding to and making demands for a bigger, more open society. The civil rights movement plays a role, has a profound effect on a new generation of young people whose experiences in the South shattered their illusions about what American freedom means. See, they grew up in this age of anti-communism where freedom was in some ways this negative thing. And they began to think of freedom differently in the context of working in Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana. And it put them in contact with a lot of white intellectuals and other intellectuals and young students coming to Mississippi Freedom Summer. They were in contact with black intellectuals who had long advocated radical changes in both American society and movements for change. When I say intellectuals, I don't mean formal intellectuals. Some were, but some were like Fannie Lou Hamer or Eunita Blackwell, people like that, Ella Baker, who were thinking about these things and really laying out a different vision of society. They also faced and had to deal with mass urban unrest in the midst of the Great Society, the war on poverty, the success of all the civil rights legislation. You get between 1964 and 72, 300 cities blowing up. You know, Watts being the epicenter of urban rebellion. Police and National Guard turned black neighborhoods into war zones, arresting at least 60,000 people, employing tanks, machine guns, tear gas to pacify the community. So whenever people start talking about posse comitatus and all the stuff about how you can't really use domestic military for domestic problems, well, in this case, this is insurgency. That's where you had the most usage of domestic armed forces in the United States. And finally, you have the war on poverty. Now, the fact that a country as wealthy as the United States, the self-proclaimed leader of the free world, was actually racked with poverty and deepening inequality kind of created a crisis of legitimacy for the United States. So think about this. You have great society liberalism, which, by the way, is the brainchild of American liberal intellectuals, not Johnson's empathy for the poor. But that great society liberalism was not, and I repeat, was not antithetical to militarism. They went hand in hand. You know, Dr. King was disturbed, as he should be, that you're spending, you know, all this money to kill Vietnamese and just a paltry sum of money to fight the war on poverty. Nevertheless, The war on poverty was accompanied by what? The expansion of police, the expansion of prisons, and the expansion of war. And it is precisely out of U.S. Cold War imperatives of extending foreign aid to third world countries as a way to solve the problem of poverty abroad that poverty at home came to be understood. And there's a wonderful essay by Alyosha Goldstein talks about this. He talks about how, you know, poverty was associated in the early 1960s with foreignness. That is to say that, you know, that the poor within the domestic borders are poor because they're different. The ghetto, the barrio, the reservation, and Appalachia were constantly represented as a different country, another country, isolated and beyond the dominant values of U.S. society. And so, in some ways, Michael Harrington's book, The Other American, he was a new left person. And he's not necessarily condemning that, but again, the metaphor that he's using is the other America, the foreign America, the America that we need to use the same tactics that we use to solve the problem of poverty in Colombia or Ethiopia that we're going to apply to these particular regions. Now, what does that mean? It means that poverty is a problem of isolation. It's a problem of values. It's not a problem of the market. It's not a problem of capitalism. So you've got, and I'm making a big leap here, the idea is that if you can simply train people, give them skills, teach them how to be good consumers and good workers, good Americans, make them no longer foreign, that somehow, because the market is so robust, because capitalism is so inclusive, they're just going to rise up. And we know that's not what happened. The National Welfare Rights Organization, the Poor People's Campaign, disagreed. They said it is a problem of wages. It is a problem of not having living wage jobs. It's a problem of discrimination in employment. It is a problem of discrimination in labor unions. It is a problem of basic income. It's a problem of gender discrimination. And in fact, it's also worth noting, just a side note, that Dr. King and Reverend Abernathy's inspiration for the war on poverty, for their own Poor People's Campaign, came not from Chicago, but from Mississippi. But they were in Mississippi when they decided to wage that war. Again, the South. What I just described, of course, mirrors the Global South's response to poverty. So in short, what liberals faced in the streets, on university campuses, sometimes in the fields and factories, was a revolutionary insurgency and a disavowal of liberalism, okay? And if we were to take that story and extend it out to the rest of the world and say, what does 68 look like globally? Then the truth of the matter is that if you tally up all the revolts, the revolutions, the people's wars, the rebellions, the riots, then from 1968 to 1971, the vast majority of 68, you know, insurgencies are coming from the global South, not from Europe, not from the United States. That's where most of it, I mean, the Philippines, Thailand, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Iran, the whole Arab world, Tunisia, Egypt, Iraq, Turkey, Palestine, Colombia, Peru, Venezuela, Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, Chile, Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, the Bahamas, Bermuda. I mean, you can go on and on. In fact, the massive strikes and street demonstrations that erupted in Curacao, in Bermuda, in the Bahamas and Jamaica, Trinidad, Aruba, Anguilla, in 1968, 69, and 70, these were people's revolts. You had a general strike, for example, in Trinidad that almost overthrew Eric Williams' regime in 1970. And with that, I'm just going to share one story. Some of you know about what's called the Rodney Riots in Jamaica. Well, who's Walter Rodney? Walter Rodney was one of the great historians. He studied African history. He was from Guyana. He studied in London, ended up getting a PhD, taught at the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, but also at one point in 1968, in January, he got a gig teaching at the University of West Indies Mona campus. So he shows up. And so part of my point is that when Rodney showed up, there was already a Black Power movement emerging. He didn't invent it. And so part of the mythology is that, you know, Rodney comes to Jamaica and he starts Black Power and everyone's following him. It's not really true. There's a young Rastafarian named Robin Jerry Small who launched a monthly periodical called Black Man Speaks. in 68, and he was part of a group of young radicals who were students at Jamaica College, and Jamaica College was actually a high school in Kingston. This publication, plus our own and other publications that are emerging at a time when the Jamaican government banned the writings of Black Power advocates like Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, and Malcolm X. Malcolm X was banned in Jamaica, you know, in 68. It's interesting because I went there in 69, visit family, and I didn't know that. You know, all I knew is that the popular song on the radio was a song called Sister Big Stuff. You know, it's another story. Anyway, so you can, if you read this wonderful book of essays, The Groundings with My Brothers by Walter Rodney, you see essays that kind of, that are in some ways summaries or actual speeches that he gave to the people who are living outside of the university world. I mean, Rastafarians, working class people, the unemployed. He spoke wherever he spoke, and he went everywhere. And he has a wonderful critique of the Jamaican state in an essay called Statement of the Jamaican Situation. And then he has also a very class analysis in his essay, Black Power, Basic Understanding. Anyway, the story is that he goes to this Black Writers Conference in Montreal, gives a speech, he comes back to Jamaica, and they don't let him in the country because they see him as a threat. You know, and he's banned from entering. Students at University of West Indies organize a march. About 2,000 people show up. They're not all students. Some are Rastafarians. Some are workers, unemployed. The police attack. Violence erupts. Cars are overturned. And soon it became clear that this was not about academic freedom. This wasn't just about Rodney. This was an expression of class anger. As businesses were targeted, they hit the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, which I would have hit too, just by the name. The Bank of London and the Bank of Montreal, Pan American Airlines, Woolworth, all attacked. And they protested recent fare hikes by overturning and burning 53 buses. So in other words, this is an insurgency. And I just give that as a quick example of one of many of these kinds of rebellions and riots which actually have an economic foundation. Those kinds of rebellions of 68, I argue, are foundational for what comes later. By 1974, you get something called the New International Economic Order, and that is a group of 77 Global South countries, the G77, which puts out a declaration demanding economic sovereignty of the post-colonial states. And they're calling for things like an absolute right of states to control the extraction and marketing of their domestic natural resources. They're calling for the establishment and recognition of state-managed resource cartels to stabilize in commodity prices, like OPEC, for example. They want regulation of transnational organizations. They want technology transfers without strings attached from global north to global south. They want preferential trade preferences for countries of the global south. And they also want debt forgiveness, you know. And what they're also sort of implying is that we were colonies for all these years, and extraction of wealth came from us. And so therefore, we're all at a bad footing, and so we want some kind of equity. And it should be clear that the New International Economic Order wasn't opposed to trade. They weren't even opposed to free trade, but they wanted certain rules that would manage international trade in order to maintain global balance. Short story is, and I'm going to skip over a lot of this, is that in response to the G77, you get the G7. And the G7 is like, we're gangsters of the global north, and you can't come to us asking for fairness in the system, because that's not how it works. And that's how the G7's born. But my point is that some of the elites who push forward for the New International Economic Order were concerned about their own people. They didn't want bread riots. They didn't want the banks in Jamaica or in Barbados or in, you know, they didn't want those banks being burned. They wanted to manage their own rebellion. So that's part of the story. And I want to just quickly end by talking about Mississippi, because I think Mississippi is the most important state in the nation right now. And I think it has been for a long time. We think of Mississippi in terms of 64, Freedom Summer, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party's stand in Atlantic City. But the year after the March on Selma, the year after the Voting Rights Act is passed, SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, organized the Mississippi Freedom Labor Union, right? And organized a lot of agricultural workers in the Delta. We think of SNCC as sort of civil rights, but they're not interested in desegregation. What they're interested in is economic and social justice. And so part of what they do was organize a strike in spring of 65. 350 members of the union, cotton choppers, went on strike to demand $1.25 an hour. In January 1966, they took over the Greenville Air Force Base, which was about to be sold, and strikers occupied it. This is Occupy Mississippi, in an attempt to focus federal attention on their plight. And the Air Force expelled them, but they fought this fight. And strikers finally created what they called Tent City, known as Strike City, and appealed to liberal organizations and the government to send food, clothing, basic commodities so they could survive. My point is that this sets us up for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party as this radical organization fighting for economic justice. If we, and I'm skipping over some stuff, but if you just look at what their 68 platform is, they're not dead after 64. They continue to live. Fannie Lou Hamer dies in 1977. She never abandons that organization. But in any case, they had a different agenda than the mainstream party. When the Democratic Party in Mississippi became the interracial Democratic Party, it incorporated some of the black elites like Charles Evers and others. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party did not give up their prerogative to exist as an independent organization. And so this is what they pushed for: guaranteed annual income, that is basic income, extended daycare, paid for by state and federal government, comprehensive medical care, increased federal provisions for food stamps, right? Free higher education. Bernie Sanders didn't come up with that. You know, I mean, really. They were thinking that in Mississippi, okay? In Mississippi. End to the Vietnam War and end to all compulsory military service as the end of the draft. A renewed diplomatic ties to Cuba and China, right? An embargo on arms to South Africa and specifically Israel, but all Middle East, which would include Saudi Arabia, right? But by 1968, even the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party came across as kind of reformist because of some of their relationships to the Democratic Party. So we jump forward. By the 68 generation, early 70s, you begin to see the emergence of something that looks like guerrilla warfare, that is, armed self-defense, armed struggle in Mississippi in the late 60s. Militants like John Buffington and Rudy Shields and others directly challenge the white power structure in Mississippi, both electorally and economically, for which that community faced violent retaliation and assassination. January 24th, 1970, the office of Clay County Community Development was firebombed in response to a planned boycott of white businesses. And what was happening was that the white businesses were basically pushing for a really problematic school phony desegregation plan, which wasn't desegregation at all, but actually re-implementing segregation. The next day, in retaliation to the firebombing of the Clay County Community Development Corporation, which of course was run by Buffington, dynamite somehow was planted in the Clay County courthouse and blew a hole in the concrete foundation. No one knows who did that. But this is what they were doing, waging guerrilla warfare. White supremacists come to them, they respond and they retaliate. The police arrested Buffington and five other black activists, including John Thomas Jr., and charged them with conspiracy. The charges didn't stick, but a few months later, Thomas was sitting outside in broad daylight and was assassinated by a white man. It's 1970. 1970 was also the year that two students were killed by police amid protests in Jackson State. May 13th, hundreds of students from Jackson State and also Millsaps College held anti-war and anti-racist protests for which they were gunned down.
You're listening to Robin Kelly, The Dream of Revolution. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
The final thing I want to segue to is that this is the context in which the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa began to settle in Mississippi. It was founded in Detroit in March of 1968 by two brothers, Gaidi and Imari Obadeli. They were born Milton and Richard Henry, with support from a wide range of Black radical activists, Queen Mother Audley Moore, Amiri Baraka, Mabel and Robert Williams, Max Stanford, and others. And they had initially considered an electoral strategy to take over the Mississippi Delta and other Black-majority counties and then build a movement to demand independence, that is, separation of Mississippi from the United States. Okay? The organization then developed a new strategy of organizing economic cooperatives, because they realized the electoral strategy wasn't going anywhere, building educational and medical institutions to serve the people, and ultimately they were calling for a UN plebiscite to allow Black people to vote for their independence, to decide. This new nation was identified as the Cush District. You know, it's a contiguous area of Black-majority counties in the western part of the state bordering Mississippi. And this would, and the idea would, they would win recognition from the international community as a Republic of New Africa. The social and economic organization of society would be along cooperative socialist lines. In other words, they're holding on to the 68 generation, the vision of global imagination, right, of 68, not the neoliberal one. To quote their own program, all industry and agriculture are owned by the people as a whole and administered by the Republic of New Africa. People are trained and assigned work in accordance with their preference, their ability, and the needs and community of, and the nation. After community needs are satisfied, wealth is equally divided among all workers. So in any case, the provisional government for the Republic of New Africa established itself in Mississippi in 1970, with more members moving down to Jackson from Detroit and elsewhere the following year. Their initial efforts to buy land were met by what? Violence. And they have money. They're not trying to steal land. They're not trying to seize land and force people out. They're not trying to dispossess anyone. They're trying to pay for it from Black farmers. So the state steps in, vigilantes step in, the police and the FBI step in, and we know what happens next. That is, a war follows. The state's quest to interrogate, then assassinate. They raided homes and headquarters. They incarcerated leaders of the RNA, resulting in the case of the RNA 11. But there were also more casualties on the state side. And I don't have time to talk about that story, but there was a shootout between the RNA and the police, and the RNA were so well organized that they lost no casualties, but the state did. And they were arrested, and eventually they ended up in prison. There's another story which I'm going to skip over, which just has to do with what the result was, because even though the RNA lost some of the battles for land, one of the reasons they lost was because of the planter bloc, as Clyde Woods talks about, literally pushed to industrialize both agriculture and industry in manufacturing. And so what you get in Mississippi is massive cotton farms using millions of pounds of toxins, pesticides. You got hazardous waste sites scattered everywhere. Petrochemical industries create Cancer Alley between Mississippi and Louisiana. In the Delta, Baton Rouge, you've got all these things that have caused environmental havoc, displacement and dispossession in terms of capital movement. If you could look at the Green Revolution in Mississippi and look at the Green Revolution in India and look at the Green Revolution in other parts of the Global South, and it's the same story. And I won't go into that, but that's basically what happens. Nevertheless, despite that, the spirit of 68 prevailed in Jackson, because in 2013, Chokwe Lumumba, the late Chokwe Lumumba, who came from Detroit, was one of the founders of the RNA, he became mayor of Jackson. His son, Chokwe Antar Lumumba, is currently the mayor of Jackson. And the way they won, we could talk about that, but Lumumba was a radical lawyer. Again, remember the New African People's Organization, remember the Malcolm X grassroots movement, and part of that first migration to Mississippi from Detroit. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, the Malcolm X grassroots movement developed something called the Jackson Plan, along the Cush Plan. and that is designed to build a base of autonomous power in Jackson that could serve as a catalyst for the attainment of black self-determination and democratic transformation of the economy. What did they do? Well, they tried to establish, and they're still trying to establish, a solidarity economy akin to the Mondragon, a corporation in Spain's Basque region, through worker cooperatives, through eco-friendly community gardens, through building inexpensive, energy-efficient housing, developing community and conservation land trusts that will make land available to the community and house the homeless. This is how they want to restore the commons. But the plan included a political strategy of creating people's assemblies, open meetings to discuss community needs, and ensure full democratic participation. And so that sort of thing. We could talk more about that. I want to close by saying that I'm not invoking the spirit of 68 out of nostalgia or a duty to commemorate, nor am I suggesting that we can ever return to that moment or reproduce the fervor and the belief that a new world was in the offing. On the contrary, I'm suggesting that it is hardly dead, that if you go to Mississippi right now, it's there. If you go to Newark, it's there. If you go to those who are crushed under the neoliberal movement in Detroit, it's still there. The spirit of 68 is a specter, an unfinished revolution haunting the current order. It haunts us even as neoliberalism and its offspring, liberal multiculturalism, seeks to rewrite the history of the moment. So I return to 68 as a counter to the normalization of the state of emergency we are currently facing. That's not the only alternative. And in truth, we've been facing some form of a state of emergency in one form or another for the last three decades. So we need to look back to see how these struggles looked ahead in order to produce a radically different future. And I also want to remind us finally in the academy that the revolutionary insurgencies of a half century ago made it possible for many of us to be here. And the spirits of those movements continue to haunt our work, the university, and our dreams. In these dark times, we need to remember that the dream of revolution was rooted in what Dr. King called a dangerous unselfishness. The idea that we have no choice but to make a difference in the lives of the most vulnerable. I mean, that's what he talked about in his final speech before he died, a dangerous unselfishness. If we are to carry the spirit of 68, we have to create a university that doesn't just serve the needs of aggrieved communities, but draws on knowledge embedded in those communities. We have to become partners in knowledge production to maintain an organic relationship to social movements, the incubators of emancipatory thinking. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Could you see the Southern, like, conservative existence as possibly growing to the same level of prominence and oppression?
Okay, good question. Yeah.
So I have two questions.
Okay.
They're related, though. Do you think there is a parallelism between the 68 rebellion and the recent election of Bolsonaro in Brazil, mm-hmm. and then the Maduro administration in Venezuela? And then going forward, how do you think marginalized groups should proceed in terms of, like, neoliberalism with that, I guess, like, turning point, but not that you mentioned earlier?
Right. In other words, overthrowing neoliberalism or operating within it?
Both.
Okay. Well, you know, your first question is actually tied to your question in many ways. So just to make sure I understand it, part of the question is whether or not the conservative tendencies in the U.S. South are similar to the conservative tendencies in the global South. And there are a lot of similarities, but again, it's very hard to think about similarities outside of time. So very specific historical processes. So if you think about what does the so-called global South and the U.S. South have in common, these were regions, at least in the Western Hemisphere, built around land possession, slavery, dispossession of indigenous peoples, and most importantly, forms of extractive industry and agriculture. And it just so happens that in places like in Brazil or Mexico or the U.S. South, large land holdings and power inland was really, really important. Things changed, though. So imagine a country like Mexico that, after the revolution, is able to develop something like a social, not something like, but develop a very robust social democracy around state ownership of extractive industries and of strong trade unions. And so in some ways, it's not that the old Latifundia class was killed. They continued to exist. But they existed alongside, especially in the 1930s, and the Cardenas, a very strong social democratic leadership. But then Mexico changes, and those changes have a lot to do with things like, you know, global debt, the debt regime. It has to do with the fact that they're pumping oil and using oil as collateral for future and borrowing money on the idea that oil prices remain high. They're also being subjected to austerity, IMF. And so that changes the circumstances in which conservative forces could emerge. So they're not the same old conservative forces. And the same thing with the U.S. South. Clyde Wood's book, Development Arrested, is one of the most brilliant books ever written. It's an amazing book about Mississippi. And he shows that the old planter class continued to hold power, but their power changed as the economy changes and as other things begin to change. Now, the thing is, what is the old conservative rule? The old conservative rule doesn't always look, it doesn't always come from the same class, or the same fragment of a class. You know, to make a leap to the question about Bolsonaro and Maduro, I could say a little bit about Brazil, and that is that, you know, there's the question of what are the conservative forces, I say neo-fascist forces, that would give rise to like someone like Bolsonaro. But then what are the forces that would lead to an overwhelmingly popular election for him? And I think they're two different questions. He gets support globally because his policies are very positive for the continued free trade policies that relate to Brazil's economic strength. And by economic strength, that's not the same thing as reducing inequality, but it leads to economic strength in relationship to global trade. So in some ways, he is the Trump choice. But I have to say, I don't think that a hard left candidate would be Obama's choice, you know, to be honest. I'm not saying Obama would support Bolsonaro, but if someone were like to the left of Lula, I don't think Obama would support, because to go back to the Maduro regime, that's a mess. That's a mess for lots of different reasons. It's a mess because there are authoritarian tendencies within the state. They haven't been able to provide basic social services. Some of that has to do with factors that are external. Some have to do with internal factors. But what was Obama's position on Hugo Chavez? He couldn't stand him. I mean, he never said it out loud, but the Obama administration, if they could have overthrown Chavez, they would have. You know? So in some ways, internal conservative reactionary forces within these nation states, as long as they're able to maintain the global trade regime, to maintain the dominance within the BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, South Africa, India, China, and can sustain this kind of global economy, they'll be okay. What's interesting, and this goes back to the other question about 68, I think that the insurgencies in opposition to Bolsonaro is definitely within that spirit of 68. Because keep in mind that in Sao Paulo, they not only have a robust opposition, which is not winning, but they elected the first trans woman to the state legislature. I mean, that's a huge thing in Brazil. They also have like really quite visionary radical organizations like MST, which is, you know, the landless workers movement. And they're growing in size, but what we're seeing is intense battles and struggles and even violence between groups like MST in this new regime. So I'm not sure if that answers the question, but I do know that one of the things that is different between, say, 68 and now is that now we have this wave of authoritarianism. In 68, what we saw were liberal regimes. De Gaulle was a liberal regime. The Kennedys, Johnson's liberal regime. Some exceptions were like Brazil, which was under dictatorship. But that was a dictatorship partly organized and manufactured by the United States and ITT, you know? And what did we get in 1970? We get the election of Allende in Chile, right? You also get the anti-colonial struggles in Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, Angola, all of them based on a socialist model of development. And the anti-apartheid struggles of the ANC are also based on a socialist model. So that was the movement that was dominant. And what happens in Jamaica? Jamaica, after the so-called Rodney Riots, those uprising rebellions, you get Michael Manley elected. And he's considered to the left.
What's different now about the way that the economic condition interacts with the conditions and form of oppression that we have now and the potential for revolution? So it could be a critical juncture for revolution or the coherence of a new form of capitalist militarist oppression.
My question was kind of related. So in your presentation, you talked about how 1968 isn't dead and there's not really a sort of push to, like, you know, the sort of exact fervor of 1968 isn't going to be recreated. We can't, like, go back in time and pull that moment. But there does seem to be some sort of radical potential, some sort of radical imagination in the last few years, specifically the last few months, all around with the elections and just everything. So what sort of fervor do you see, or like what sort of radical whatever do you see coming, if anything?
Right. Excellent. Those are two excellent questions, and they are connected. So let me begin with this one. Has anyone seen the film Finally Got the News? Okay, it's about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and it is a beautiful film. It was made in 1971, and I think you see it online. But in Finally Got the News, it opens up with John Watson, who's a member of the League, and he's giving this lecture to the camera. And one of the things he talks about is exactly this issue, that specifically the black working class, and he's talking about Detroit, is essential. That if we all stop working, we could shut down production. And this is exactly the point. And he lays it out, and what we know is that at the very moment, this is 1971, this is the beginning of the global slump. This is the beginning of restructuring of capital, where you not only have more mobility of capital, but you have certain, with the U.S. going off the gold standard and with the global slump, the opportunity for greater capital mobility and seeking out cheaper labor elsewhere, whole manufacturing processes moving away. So as he's saying that, the potential for that power is disappearing, like literally as they're speaking. It doesn't mean that manufacturing disappears from the U.S. because it actually is robust. To this day, the U.S. still manufactures more than almost any country except for China. You know, it still manufactures, but it's still not the kind of power, not nearly what you had. So you don't have the kind of opportunity where a industrial strike could shut down production. You also have, at the same moment, greater automation. And automation was a problem in the 70s, it's still a problem today. Even as jobs become cheaper in terms of their value, in terms of wage value, in terms of the percentage of wages to GDP keeps shrinking and shrinking. In other words, we're getting paid less and less and less for terrible jobs. And even if those jobs are productive, and automation is a factor as well. So it is true, that opportunity disappears. The question is, if we think of capital as global, whether or not those opportunities appear in other places. In other words, if you think about China, as a massive manufacturer, but also in terms of finance. General strikes in China can make a huge difference in a really repressive regime, but instead, the way we often think of China in terms of the popular democratic discourse is as competitor. Not as another body of the working class, but as competitor. So when Obama, I remember, I'll never forget when he was debating Romney, Obama said something like, you know, I don't really care about Chinese workers. I want to make sure that our workers get a fair wage. That a president could say that, but as someone concerned about the world, you want everyone's wages to rise, and you don't want to have sweatshop conditions. So what we're getting is a global sweatshop, the transformation of labor over the last 25 years in which a whole nations that were predominantly extractive, agricultural, are now low-wage manufacturing labor in tech, in garments, in, you know, all these different things. And that is the working class. They're not the competitors. The whole economic nationalism, which in some ways is just a chimera for what's behind it, and that is the real neoliberal, is to say that, you know, there should be no boundaries around capital. Capital needs to be encased. Capital needs to flow. It's people that need to be bounded. But the chimera of economic nationalism to say, like, we really want to improve wages for Americans and move jobs back. No one's interested in that. They're not interested. In fact, what they're interested in creating jobs at even lower wages. And then again, to go back to Obama, one of Obama's big, the great bailout of GM meant a 50% wage cut for workers in GM and for those who are coming in who are not grandfathered in, who don't have seniority. So it was a terrible deal for workers, but that's where we are. So what's the good news? Is it good news? Is this a good news? And this is partly the answer to your question, but there's more to it. The good news is that in places where you have almost no visible means of economy, the opportunities to create economy, worker-owned cooperatives, using participatory budgeting to take control of city budgets. And this is a form of capitalism. It's a form of capital accumulation, but it's a capital accumulation that's based on cooperative ownership and basically trying to care for other people. So when we see this in Mississippi, we see cooperatively owned companies where people are using like 3D printers and things like that to make things, to manufacture things for need. Community gardens that are not necessarily made for commercial profit, but for, you know, sustaining. So that's what we're witnessing, that in places of abandonment, the transformation of those abandoned lands and abandoned processes are potentials for new kinds of communities, new kinds of organization of production. The problem is that whenever they succeed, you get Detroit. And Detroit means that the people who created through abandonment, by taking advantage of abandonment, vibrant local economies, they're being dispossessed right now under new gentrification. And because those lands were squatted, they were not necessarily owned. And so we get stuck again. That's why I go back to the whole question of what does it mean to have property? So we have these opportunities, but every time you create an opportunity like that, you got to be prepared for the state to come down on you. Be prepared for the very kinds of dispossessions and violences that we've witnessed for the last 500 years. And it's going to happen. Which leads me to the question, this is one of the really positive places. I'm so enthusiastic about this younger generation of activists. They're better than any generation we've ever had. They're better than the 68 generation. And the reason why I say that is because they're attending to the very things that, in that list of five things, were often treated as lip service, like gender, sexuality, you know, as part of what people are struggling for. That's not identity politics. That's about lifting forms of oppression off of people's backs so they could live, right? They're trying to figure out ways to love one another and make struggle and be participatory, which means, you know, finding space for people to speak, to be heard, to new ways of learning, new ways of producing knowledge, and understanding that, you know, there's something better in life than becoming a cog in a neoliberal wheel. And there's a whole generation of people who are doing that and sacrificing in that way and creating kind of forms of community which are rich. The problem is, of course, they may not have means of production. They may not have, like, their fingers on a pulse where they could shut things down, but they have other ways to shut things down through forms of civil disobedience and by recognizing that the old way of thinking about democracy, that is, democracy is simply being able to vote for a representative who you hope will do what you want them to do, is not working, and there's got to be new forms of democratic practice. Finally, this is a generation that is immensely globally literate. And what I mean by that, you're talking about people who actually come from all over the world who understand that you have to know the world. And that's what I get in my classroom. You know, I teach a class, 400 students, neoliberalism. And I got students from all over the globe. And they're really struggling with these questions in a way that's very, very serious. So I'm very hopeful. And that's why I don't want to say that people need to go back to 68. But also, part of what I was trying to say was that some of the basic principles that Dr. King talked about, which played itself out through the global imagination of the New Left, hadn't died. they actually continue to exist. And in fact, you all are the inheritors of that. And you've inherited that and built on it in some significant ways. That doesn't answer all the questions, but thank goodness it's not my job to answer all the questions. So thank you.
You were just listening to Robin Kelly on The Dream of Revolution. He spoke at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Robin Kelly is professor of history at UCLA and an award-winning author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media organization Rise Up. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Michelle Alexander, Chris Hedges, Michael Eric Dyson, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Angela Davis. We also have copies of Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic Beyond Vietnam speech. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Robin Kelly, The Dream of Revolution, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.